Hey, happy Saturday morning to you, wherever you happen to be today. We hope you're having a great Saturday. This is Real Life with Beth and Rob. I am Rob Hall. That is Beth Guckenberger.
Yes, I am.
Good morning, Bethy Beth.
Hi, honey. Good morning.
Second Saturday morning in a row that I get to say,
you're here
I'm
in
enjoying Monterey.
I know.
And come on.
Monterey, Mexico. We're in the heart of the Sierra Madre Mountains, right there in the basin. Every direction you turn,
it is
beautiful.
And if you can't say that, if you're in like Des Moines
or
Kansas City or my hometown of Cincinnati, or if you're in San Diego or some other place, we hope you're having a great Saturday, wherever that is.
Yes, we do.
Absolutely.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing fabulous.
Yes.
I'm doing great. And I am going to let people in on the conversation we were having right before we came on air.
Really?
About your LASIK surgery.
Really, this is important.
This is very important because it's hilarious.
Oh, my sweet listeners. Yes. I live in Mexico where services are less expensive than they are in the United States. So I found a LASIK surgeon here who would do my LASIK surgery on my basically bat-blind eyes for a mere $800. And I decided that was a deal I could not refuse.
Yeah, I bet it was. And so I compared that to getting it like a tattoo in Tijuana as compared to getting a tattoo like it's, I mean,
you know what?
$800.
I mean,
what? Where are they cutting corners for $800?
I am sure that it's the other way around. The American ophthalmologists are just raking it in. That they are over.
Now, I'm sure you can write your emails, all the ophthalmologists or wives of kids of ophthalmologists, BethGuckenberger@gmail.com.
The whole thing took 5 minutes, so who the heck should be making, you know,
so I'm curious, and maybe somebody could clue us in on our Facebook page, Real Life with Beth and Rob.
You said
it hurt like crazy
for
5 minutes. It was the most terrifying 5 minutes, but it was only 5 minutes.
I was just commenting to you that no one really told me what the five-minute experience was going to be like.
But it would just be 5 minutes.
They just kept emphasizing it's 2 minutes the first eye, 3 minutes the second eye, and which I still don't really understand why one eye was slightly longer than the other. but anyway, for her 20 seconds on each eye, well, everything went black. And I have to confess, in those 20 seconds, a possible explicative went through my brain. Like, what was I thinking? But then I woke, you know, for 24 hours and I couldn't see anything.
So what,
you know,
I don't,
eyes closed.
What I don't know,
and now
and
I'm looking
I need
at you right
some
now,
feedback on from
me.
Our listeners. Somewhere, probably our Facebook page is the best place. And maybe I can remember to post something on there or whatever,
well,
as long
not,
as Beth doesn't delete
not
it.
About my LASIK
Beth might
surgery.
Delete it. Should LASIK surgery be incredibly painful?
No, okay, incredibly might be an exaggeration. I would say incredibly uncomfortable.
Okay.
And
so
I'm guessing
the maybe $4,200 that you saved by having it done in someone's basement here in Monterey was the part about it should last longer than 2 minutes and it shouldn't hurt like crazy.
I can see. That's really when I realized at the end, like after the 20 seconds, everything went black and then things were like really fuzzy. Cause
everything went black. I imagine for those 20 seconds, you're like, oh no!
I was like,
they miscalibrated the laser. They burnt out my retina.
Did you look at my name tag on my bracelet? Do you know who I am? But I was a little concerned for a few seconds. I will confess that. But then once it was like real fuzzy at first.
Yes.
It gets better over time.
That concern was eliminated within 20 seconds because the pain took over. And you didn't have enough time to be concerned about the fact that you couldn't see anything at that point. It was just incredibly painful.
Well, I will have to say, I mean, I have a pretty high pain threshold. But after the first day, oh my gosh, I have to do that again.
So let's just go ahead and make a disclaimer right now. What we're not saying. Is that if people are contemplating LASIK surgery, that Beth's experience in the basement of someone's
I would still
doctor's office
it, cause now I
is
don't, not
the
glasses.
Experience you would have if you went to the LASIK surgeon.
Yes, but
the outcome you're very pleased with.
I would do it all over again.
Yes, but I'm wondering if the process, your $800 process,
I would do it again.
Had something to do with the difference between what might be a more expensive process in
would
the
do
States.
Do it again.
I hear you.
My
you
point.
Do it again.
Okay.
I hear you.
Because I would spend $800 easily in glasses in the next 2 years.
Yes. I want to switch subjects here. By the way, we're going to have a great show.
I'm excited.
I want people to know that. We have two really cool guests.
Yes.
And I love this because, again, part the second guest who's going to be on, Kim DeBlaycourt, has written, it's a story. It's a true, great story. Until We All Come Home, a harrowing journey, a mother's courage, a race to freedom about her son being imprisoned in Russia and her journey to get him out of prison.
Yeah, it's a good,
a great story. Mm-hmm. Right? But what I love is, so that's a great riveting story. And then the first guest we'll have on right after the break, Paul Nyquist has written a book with his son, The Post-Church Christian. So it's more of sort of a cerebral look at the difference in generations, and how they look at church and all that kind of stuff. Yep. So it's going to be a great show. But before we get there, I don't know how much time we have left. Maybe like 2-3 minutes or something like that.
Yes, tell me.
I have to let people know about your husband. I don't know what his deal is. I mean, he's like, he drove from Monterey to Cincinnati, right? You're moving home.
We are moving.
Moving to Cincinnati, and so let's all have a quick moment of silence.
Mm-hmm. That would be more than a moment, but
okay,
yes.
So that was a quick moment. You can't really have moments of silence on the radio.
No, that's everything.
Because everyone just hits another button. They're like, I guess something went wrong.
Yes, exactly.
So, but that counted just sort of. So you're going home to Cincinnati. How long is a trip usually? Like if you were driving.
Well, it's a 30-hour drive in a typical car.
30-hour drive in a typical car. And obviously no one's going to drive 30 hours in a row. Who would do that?
Yeah, well, and my husband drove a moving truck. So it wasn't even like
Not even a car.
It was like a 24-foot
moving
truck.
It might be 3 days. You chop it up into even 10-hour drive. Maybe 4 days.
Yeah, more like 4 days.
4 days. The normal human being would take 4 days.
Especially when you're driving two of your offspring.
You're driving two sons in a truck full of all your stuff.
From one country to the next.
From one country to the next, 30 hours.
He did.
So when did your husband leave?
He left at 5 o'clock on one morning and was home by midnight on the second morning.
Who does this?
You know what?
Now, here's the coup. The coup de grace, the cherry on top of the ice cream on this one.
Yes.
When he got home, weary from his 30-hour drive done in literally 36 hours, if that, 34 hours, he unpacks the van.
It's not a van. It's a moving truck.
He unpacks the moving truck when he gets home. He doesn't even like, oh, let's just tackle this in the morning. Let's get some dinner. Let's get some rest. Bang.
I'm like, 10, 15 years past nagging him about all these things.
Oh, my gosh. That's craziness.
He's not even normal.
But I could just imagine. He's like, we're doing this.
Yeah.
Do it right or do it over, sons. The other thing I imagine is that your kids are probably like, pushing every little button, like, Dad, we could go another couple hours. And he's like, yes, we could, kids. We're going to do this.
He said that our 12-year-old son had about a six-pack of Mountain Dew by the time they got home. I said, well, he won't sleep for the rest of the week.
Go ahead and pee in that can, son, because we're not stopping.
Yes, they had their boy beef jerky and their, loaded up Red Bulls, and they got there in a day and a half.
Oh, my gosh.
The other children and I are going to drive the minivan. I said, I'm taking the better half of the week.
I was going to say, you're going to leave, like, the day that you leave, you're going to be home, like, 7 days later.
We're stopping at Mom and Pop Restaurant.
Let's stop at San Antonio. It's really not on the way, but, I've always wanted to do the river walk.
That's exactly how I've told them. That's how they decided which parent they were going with. Who wants the experience and who wants expediency?
That's right. And so the boys hopped in and said,
yes,
we're out of here. Uh-huh. Other than Aiden, and that's a whole other story. He's the lonely man on campus, which makes him the big man on campus.
But he's the lonely man.
Oh, two just fabulous stories there.
I'm
glad you can see.
Yes. Yeah. I can totally see, and I can see you enough to know that I am so excited about these two shows. I think that one of the things that we're going to be able to do in the balance of the hour is address some of those generational differences that are creating more crashes now than they ever have in the last 100 years. Yeah. I've been reading lots actually about the generational differences and the way that
and
we
a
approach.
Unique book. We're going to talk with Paul Nyquist right after the break. The Post-Church Christian, dealing with the generational baggage of our faith. Oh, actually, that's after the break. Kim is next. Sorry about that. Kim DeBlaycourt is next. And we're going to be talking to her about Until We All Come Home, an incredible, compelling story about her journey to get her son out of prison in Russia. It'll be amazing. So come back after the break. This is Real Life with Beth and Rob. We'll see you in just a minute.
This past summer, I went on a back-to-back mission trip to India, where I met a little girl named Shailaja from an orphanage with back-to-back. She was a new child at the home and was having a hard time adjusting. As I began playing with her and painting her nails, I was reminded that this little girl was just like my sisters back at home in the United States. Instead of a face on a photo, she became a part of my family when I realized that I could continue to help her through back-to-back's child sponsorship program. Even though she lives over 8,000 miles away, through the back-to-back sponsorship program, I can ensure that her spiritual, physical, educational, emotional, and social needs are met. The best part about the program is when I come home from school and find a letter from Shailaja. I am so thankful for God working within both of our hearts in order to lead us closer to each other and closer to Him. Visit www.backtoback.org for more information.
Hey, welcome back. This is Real Life with Beth and Rob. I am Rob Hall. That is Beth Guckenberger. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning. Happy Saturday morning.
Happy Saturday. Hope you all are having a great Saturday, wherever you happen to be, whatever you happen to be doing, that you're having a great time doing it. At least that's our hope. We're having. Who is booking our guests?
You know what? This particular one I'm at this the Orphan Summit, she gave me
her
book.
Oh, so you did this one.
I mean, well, I didn't, like.
But you were the one
who's.
This is a great story.
I know. I'm really excited to have Kim on.
Yeah, absolutely. Kim DeBlaycourt is going to be on. She's on right now. She's a strong advocate for international adoption. She started her own organization. But we're going to be talking about Until We All Come Home, A Harrowing Journey, A Mother's Courage, A Race to Freedom. It's an incredible story about Kim and her determination to free her son from prison in Russia. So, I mean, it's just a compelling read. So, Kim, thank you so much for being on with us.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely.
Oh, Kim, I was just hoping that you could start out by telling a little bit about your story to our listeners. For those who aren't familiar with what's gone on in your life and the way that which you recorded it for us to all learn from your experiences, would you just tell us a little bit about your story?
Yes, my husband and I entered into an international adoption program, never guessing that wheels could come off. Mm. I mean, we had always talked about adoption, even in our engagement period. We were both really pro it, thought maybe it would happen later in life than it did. But secondary infertility led us to adopt early, and since I had been to the country of Ukraine, formerly of the USSR, and our church had a long ongoing program there, that was one of the countries we felt compelled to adopt from, almost called to adopt from. And once the day we met our son, Sasha, we knew. We knew he was the one that we were supposed to adopt, something that we had prayed for months about before. But it was a presidential election year in that country. There was a lot of political party fractioning going on. And there's a prosecutor involved in Ukrainian adoptions. And our particular prosecutor, a very young, ambitious man, was part of a presidential party that no longer believed international adoption was a good thing for his country. And he was trying to discourage it as much as he could. And this was happening all over the country. We would hear these little stories popping up, still never guessing that we would be one of them.
Yeah, so this is, so Kim, this is part of, I mean, just for our listeners, they may have read a little bit about Russia and them wanting to stop allowing Americans to adopt children from Russia, and so you're right in the middle of this. You're living this.
Well, now Russia and Ukraine are now separate countries.
Right.
Right. But, yeah, where I was in the Odessa Oblast of Ukraine was very much Russian-minded, Russian-settled, Russian language is what was being spoken. And, yeah, very much so. As a matter of fact, I am friends with many parents stuck in that nightmare right now.
So a very similar experience that you're now finding yourself in the middle of.
Exactly. The prosecutor was doing anything and everything to discourage adoptions there. But when God calls you to something, when do you say, oh, whoa, God, this is more than I bargained for? You didn't tell me this was going to happen. I mean, when do you turn around and go home? And that was the question that I had to keep asking myself, because I knew we were called. My husband knew we were called. And we just had to keep hanging on. We knew what God's character was. Mm-hmm. We knew that he could be trusted. We never thought we'd be tested or tried like this.
Right.
We also knew it's hard for the orphan.
Right. And I imagine you never imagined that you would now become an advocate. You know, you've started an organization, Nourished Hearts. Mm-hmm. So when you were going through this, I imagine you said, hey, man, we're going to get our son. And out of that has been birthed in you this idea that I've got to tell this story.
Well, once you go through such a struggle and you learn so much about God and you learn so much about the plight of the orphan around the world, it does change you. It turned me upside down and shook me out, and God refilled me. It's just been one of those kinds of situations that I didn't know how to go back to the person I was before. I didn't know her anymore. Yeah. I had changed after living in Ukraine for a year.
How has your son been since you've returned?
Oh, well, it was rough in the beginning. You know, he had been an orphan from day two. So there were a lot of new things for him. But we went in with our eyes open, and we just wanted to be patient and give him what he needed. When he wanted to be swaddled and rocked, that's what we did. When he wanted to play with toys for 1 and 2 year olds, even though he was 4 and 5, that's what we did. Mm. We allowed him to experience the life that he had never had at his pace. And I'm happy to tell you now that he's going to be turning 7 here at the end of the summer, he is wanting to play with toys older than himself, like much many boys do. And he's currently, as we're talking, learning how to swim at the local aquatic center.
Ah, cool. Mm. Cool. So, you know, obviously the story is your compelling story, but I'm sure that in the midst of writing it, your idea was, I want to be encouraging to families who are thinking about international adoption or mired in a similar situation. Mm. What would you say to those families right now who are going through a similar thing that you experienced?
That we need to hold true to what God's character is and his loving, overwhelming, loving heart for the orphan. He calls himself the father to the fatherless. But this story goes beyond that. I mean, the odds and the things that happened ended up almost becoming ridiculous. I mean, I had people actually campaigning for me just to turn around and come home. So this is a story basically for anyone that's going through an unexpected, tough time of testing in their life. And how holding true to what you know God to be and his ever-unchanging character can make all the difference. And I had such a great group of people around me. Can I tell you, Satan wants to get you alone, and he wants you to be away and cut you from the herd and just attack you, and that's exactly the opposite of where you need to be. You need to stay in the group of those people that love you and that will pray for you and will nurture you and will pour into you. And if you don't have that, contact me. I know where you've been. I've walked where you are, and I would love to come alongside you.
Powerful.
One of the questions I have is just, I want to clear up a misconception, because I understand as an adoptive mom who's lived internationally what you meant when you said you wouldn't recognize the Kim from before this experience after having had this experience that you changed. But could you explain that sometimes it's that fear of change that even causes people to not want to step their big toe into the adoption world, because they think, what if I become something that I don't recognize anymore, I don't understand? But would you say that who you are now is more of who God created you to be? Or could you clarify what you mean by that?
It was my relationship with God that changed. I didn't even know, Beth, that I had doubts as to whether God existed. I didn't know that I had those harbored deep inside somewhere. And through this entire process, that was ferreted out. There is no doubt in my mind that God is real and that he's alive today and that he's working through the lives of ordinary people like he has always. And once you embrace that and you experience that, your life does change for the better. everything about me, the materialism, everything that was about me as an American Christian, has been so detoured and pushed away and is so unappealing to me now. Mm-hmm. And what has developed is not only this love story with God, but when we talk about the parts of the body of Christ, I know my part in that now. You know, I'm the arms. I'm the one that has the lap. And I'm the one that has been called to orphan care in these other countries, which is how Beth and I met. Because mm-hmm. we seem to have similar hearts.
Absolutely.
And my life has never been the same since.
We are talking to Kim DeBlaycourt about her book, and much more than just about her book. She has a compelling story, Until We All Come Home, a harrowing journey, a mother's courage, a race to freedom, and just a passion about not only just adoption and her story, but you can hear in Beth, or Kim, we can hear in your voice just the passion that this has created about how to build a strong, resilient faith. And your story is a way for people to sort of get in touch with that passion.
Was there any point in your experience there in the Ukraine when you were, could you tell us about a point when you felt like maybe you're just going to go home, when you wanted to give up?
There almost became a time of despair. It wasn't, mm-hmm. I wasn't completely at rock bottom, but I think I must have been pretty close. It was after we had been told after our second appeal, after our second court date, the appeal, that we had to start all over again at square one. Mm. And I had already been in the country for 7-8 months. And I was so tired of living on frayed nerves. And at the time, I didn't know, but I was living with post-traumatic stress disorder. And there were just a lot of different things going on. And we finally get to trial number three. We finally get everything done right. There were no misspellings in the adoption decree. There was no corruption going. There was just nothing. Everything just all of a sudden seemed apart, and we were on our way to go home with this little boy, and a volcano in Iceland erupts.
Oh, yeah, I remember
that.
A
matter of hours before we were to get on the plane to get out of the plane.
My goodness.
Now, this is 11 and a half months from the day that I've arrived in Ukraine. And I've never left. And at that point, I said, you know, even Mother Nature seems to be against us getting this mm-hmm. boy home. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what plans you have for this little boy, God, or perhaps for our family, but there is something going on here. And I think that was the point that I seriously began to wonder about whether we were going to get him out. But no matter what Satan uses, even volcanoes, our God is greater.
Yeah. Amen. So, Kim, we just have a minute left. Tell us a little bit about how we can find the book and, just as importantly, Nourished Hearts, where our listeners can connect with you.
At Nourished Hearts, that's E-D and then an S at the end of hearts.com. I have also recently accepted a manager of life-changing mission trips with Food for Orphans, which partners with Vision Trust. Hmm. You can find more information at foodfororphans.org. And you can find Until We All Come Home at fine bookstores everywhere, online everywhere, and probably in your local library. And if it's not there, ask them to get it.
Well, Kim, thank you so much for being on the show. What a great and compelling story, passionate story. Just thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Kim. Blessings to you.
Absolutely.
Wow. What a story.
I mean,
we just tipped on the very tip of the iceberg of her personal story, which is in the book.
Yeah. Who has the tenacity to take a year of your life out and not, like, move to Fiji? I mean, like, she was in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Not the easiest place to get around as a foreign woman.
Oh, my gosh. Just unbelievable. So if you're looking for a great read, a story, a true story that's compelling, that's, oh, man. Please. And you can hear in her voice.
Yeah.
Until We All Come Home, Kim DeBlaycourt, would highly recommend it. And as we often do, we're going to shift gears after the break. We're going to talk with Paul Nyquist about his book, The Post-Church Christian, a great read he and his son co-wrote about dealing with the generational baggage of our faith. So, interesting stuff. So, this is Real Life with Beth and Rob, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. Hopefully, you'll join us then.
Do you have a family member who's getting older and can no longer be safely left alone? Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care, assists senior citizens and adults to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Visiting Angels has over 400 franchised locations across the nation. Experienced, compassionate caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meal preparation, and light housework up to 24 hours a day. Rates are affordable, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. Visiting Angels has cared for hundreds of thousands of seniors nationwide. Franchises are available. Call Visiting Angels toll-free today at 877-374-LIVE. To find an office near you, visit www.visitingangels.com. For home care for your loved ones, call Visiting Angels now at 877-374-LIVE. That's Visiting Angels, America's choice in home care, at 877-374-LIVE.
He found shelter under the rock and lay there looking at the stars. God, do you remember me? In Tales of the Not Forgotten by Beth Guckenberger, Joel dares to ask for what he can't have. Serafina sacrifices what she can't afford to give. Abram looks for an answer buried out of reach, and Christina, saved by a mission, searches for her own. Follow these life-changing stories as they take you on a journey to faraway lands and unfamiliar faces. Travel through their challenges and see the hand of the great story weaver writing endings you'd never imagine. These are the tales of the ones the world doesn't see, tales of the not forgotten. In Tales of the Not Forgotten, learn how God is the great story weaver, weaving the threads of our lives into a strong and beautiful sign of His love. Check out Tales of the Not Forgotten book and missions materials by Beth Guckenberger. For more information or to purchase, go to your local Christian supplier or visit standardpub.com. See lives transformed.
If becoming or staying debt-free is important to you, you're not alone. 10 years ago, I was worried sick, overwhelmed with debt, and so tired of not having enough at the end of the month to make ends meet. I was working a full-time job, but getting deeper in debt every month, and I hated being away from my children. I finally said, that's enough, and I made a decision to do whatever it took to get free from the terrible debt that was causing me so much stress. I'm Gina Neef, and I want to invite you to find the same financial freedom that I found. Not only did I pay my way out of debt, I was also able to leave my corporate job and work from home and be completely available to my family. For years now, I've worked part-time hours, making more than a full-time job would ever pay. I remember the pain of being in over my head, and I'll never forget the joy of becoming debt-free. That's why I show others how to do the same. If you're ready to work from home and find financial freedom, then I'm eager to show you how. Go to findingfreedomnow.com. Discover how you can get free from debt. Go to findingfreedomnow.com.
Last October, I went on a back-to-back mission trip to Nigeria, where I had a chance to meet the boy I sponsored through back-to-back. The moment I met him, it became real that Jeremiah was not just a boy in a picture. He was a boy with dreams, hopes, and a story just like my own kids. At that moment, I saw how back-to-back is changing the lives of orphans around the world. I realized that in the same way I'm here for my children to be part of their stories, I can also be part of Jeremiah's. In the same way that my children can be a brother or sister to each other, they can care for Jeremiah. They can write him letters and share their stories as they grow up. We can help him to receive an education and food to fill his stomach. But more importantly, we can be involved in his life and encourage him to follow his dreams. I learned that sponsoring a child through back-to-back is not just about financial support for an orphan. It is about allowing God to intertwine your story and your heart with a child in need. For more information on sponsoring an orphan like Jeremiah through back-to-back, contact 513-754-0300 or email at childsponsorship@back2back.org.
Hey, welcome back. Happy Saturday, guys, wherever you happen to be. This is Real Life with Beth and Rob. I'm Rob Hall. That's Beth Guckenberger. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning, Rob.
Again, good morning to you. What a great story that was. I'm still like, wow.
It reminds me of that old Sally Fields movie. Remember, Not Without My Daughter? That's like 25
yeah.
years ago. Where she like goes into the Middle East.
Yeah, you're but showing your age. That's
I'm
why you needed LASIK.
Telling you. Yes, you who had knee surgery. I think I like that idea that she was not leaving without her kid.
Yeah,
like
absolutely. That. And as I mentioned before the break, we're going to shift gears, but certainly not to a topic any less compelling. This is a topic that we talk about a lot.
Yes.
And that's sort of the difference between sort of Gen Xers, baby boomers, and millennials, and sort of the divide in the church. Actually, in a couple of weeks, Brian Tome and David Kinnaman are going to be on to talk. David Kinnaman's the author of Unchristian. We're going to be talking about it again. But this I love this book that we're going to be talking about now with Paul Nyquist, because he co-wrote it with his son, who is a millennial.
I love that.
Right? And so the whole book, you're not just getting like a theoretical look at what this is. You're getting a family's look at the difference.
I'd like to see the bonus DVD features on the creation of this book.
Absolutely. So Paul is joining us. Paul is the president of Moody Bible Institute in beautiful Chicago, Illinois. He served in missions as a local pastor, a professor. His son, as I mentioned, is a millennial. Carson is his name. He's a pastor, photographer, storyteller, just a compelling book. So, Paul, thanks so much for joining us. Happy Saturday to you.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you, Rob and Beth.
So, what made you want to write the book? I mean, it's something that people talk about, but it's another thing to sit it down with your son and say, "Let's write this together." I imagine it was an attention-free process.
Well, it was a fun process. It started when Carson came back. He was in seminary at that time, training to go into pastoral ministry. And we had a conversation over a Christmas break, and he was just expressing his frustration with what he saw in the church and some of the discontent that he was experiencing. And, my ears perked up, and I said, let's talk. And that started this conversation, which I recognized then that this is widespread all around the country, and this led to us deciding we got to do something. We need to write a book that really talks about the need to have unity in the church. And so the Post-Church Christian came out of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you and your son sat down to write this book, I mean, you probably heard me just say I wanted to see the bonus DVD, the bonus features on the DVD. Like, you know, I'm thinking, as a college president, you're working all the time with all kinds of generations, but predominantly this new, you know, emerging generation, and you're seeing some of their tendencies, their thought patterns. How did you actually flesh out the logistics of writing your worldview, his worldview, and pulling those together in a way that was accessible to all the rest of us?
Well, that's a great question. We had to model what we show in this book, what we are encouraging, I think, churches to look at as well. And that is, we had to sit down and really understand some of the generational differences. There's a real culture difference between millennials and I'm part of the baby boomers. Their culture emerges from the things that you experience in life. You know, my generation, well, we went through the Cold War, Vietnam, you know, Woodstock, free love, the assassinations, you know, racial tension. That's what formed our culture, our values. This generation, much different. You know, they've grown up in a time when there's just a complete breakdown in the family, spiraling debt out of control, 9/11, terrorism, the internet, an interconnected global community. I mean, it's very, very different, and as a result, they value different things. So that reflects then in how they understand what it means to follow Jesus, and that comes out in this book as we have come to understand each other better, but also, I think, trying to solve this disconnect between the church.
So getting sort of down to brass tacks a little bit, what is it that you've discovered in with working with kids, talking with your son, working out the book? What is it about millennials that they're turned off about the way that baby boomers, maybe even Gen X, does church?
Yeah, and that's what Carson writes the first half of this book. And he does so seeking to express his experiences, not just his, but basically representing a generation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he expresses that, from their perspective, boomers seem much too political, that they're trying to, the moral majority, it was a part of my generation, trying to influence Washington and policy, a church that is disengaged from culture. So we created our own Christian subculture, Christian schools, Christian movies, Christian music, Christian sports teams, you name it, Christian this, Christian that. So, you know, in an effort to try and protect our families from the influence of the world, we created this Christian subculture that is can be very disconnected from the rest of life and culture. They see a church that tends to be a little more on the legalistic side, you know, setting up rules. Don't do this, don't do that, again, in a desire to try and protect the their children from going into things that they think could harm them. And so they say, you know, this is not how we think you need to follow Jesus. And so they've seen that, and they want to go in a different direction.
And as you write sort of from the baby boomer side of things, baby boomers can tend to be some resistant to that. What is it that baby boomers are so resistant to?
Well, I'm a boomer, and so I can express this, you know, from my own heart as well, because, you know, Carson grew up in churches that I pastored. Okay?
And so, yeah, a little hard not to be defensive. He's talking about you. He's talking about your church experience.
You know, in a sense, you know, it's broader than that. But, I mean,
sure.
In a sense, he picked up on this. And so,
yeah.
You know, I was going, okay, so, like, what was so wrong with all of this
right.
that you went through, you know? And, you know, what we need to, I think, realize as boomers is, you know, they are, you know, what they're seeing is a church that they want to get back on the front lines. You know, I mentioned the book, you know, the millennials want to move the church from the country club back to the front lines. You know, in our desire to, you know, have a church that reflects our values, you know, we did create more of a country club. The mega church is a product of our generation. You didn't find those back 40, 50 years ago. It's a product of what we created. But these churches tend to meet all the needs of their members, from, you know, coffee bars to fitness centers. And this generation says, we want a gritty Jesus. We want a Jesus that is out there ministering to the real hurts of real people, because we know we're messed up. I mean, the millennials recognize we are really broken. We've got problems. And when they tend to go to church sometimes, they hear and they pick up an environment where, you know, nobody has problems here. Everything is just all worked out very nicely for people, but that's not where I'm at, man. I got problems. And I want a church where it's authentic, where people can be real, and where we're engaged with real issues that people have on the streets of this world.
You know, Rob was asking about the tension between the two generations, but you maybe just answered. I'm thinking, what can we learn from the generations? So would you say a movement towards what the millennials are asking for, more authenticity, more grit, more engagement, does that feel like to you a movement in the right direction, like your generation can learn from what your son and his generation are proposing?
Well, I think both generations can learn from the other. It's not one way. It's not unilateral. But let's take it from what we can learn from the millennials. They do have great passion. I get to hang out with 1,600 of them every single day here as the president of Moody, and these are incredible kids. They are sold out to Jesus. They want to make a difference in this world. But authenticity is a big thing to them. You know, they have the ability to sniff out that which is not genuine very, very quickly, and that turns them off. Now, you know, those in my generation, I try and explain to Carson, I don't think we are trying to be inauthentic in that, that sense.
Dr. Nyquist, can you join us after the break? I'm coming up against a hard break. I can't
absolutely.
Miss it.
Are
you able to join us afterwards?
Perfect. Absolutely.
Just a great topic. I mean, again, and Dr. Nyquist, Paul Nyquist and his son Carson, they have really torn into this. So you get this idea not just from a theoretical view, but from a very personal view about the tensions and what they're learning from one another. I love the title, Dealing with the Generational Baggage of Our Faith. It's not like the baggage of one versus the other. We both have baggage.
Yes.
Right? And so what we've begun to talk about right now is what we can learn from each other.
Yeah, the gifts. There's not just baggage. There's gifts.
That's absolutely. So hey, listener people, you're going to want to come back after the break, because we're going to keep talking about the post-church Christian. We're with Dr. Paul Nyquist. co-author of the book. So join us right after the break. This is Real Life with Beth and Rob. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Who's Weaving Your Story? The Story Weaver series by Beth Guckenberger highlights the plight of orphans throughout the world in personal, heart-grabbing stories of loss, struggle, and redemption. The kind of redemption only God, the great story weaver, can accomplish. Written for ages 8 and up, Tales of the Not Forgotten and Tales of the Defended Ones reveal God's ability to create a story far greater than we can imagine. And the corresponding 6-part Leader's Guides on CD help turn each book's content into a simple yet powerful 6-week curriculum for any church or small group. Use both together and you have a 12-week curriculum full of fun activities, compelling stories, biblical teaching, and practical applications. Let God weave your story and see what He can accomplish for orphans worldwide. The Story Weaver series is published by Standard Publishing and is available at www.standardpub.com or your favorite Christian bookstore.
Hey, welcome back. This is Real Life with Beth and Rob. I am Rob Hall, along with Beth Guckenberger. We hope you're having a fabulous, fantastic, awesome Saturday. How's that for some...
I think that's some enthusiasm and energy.
Well, I mean,
are
it's
you
hard.
A millennial?
Just I am kidding. Not, but I tend kidding. To sort of go that way, you know. So we're talking about the post-church Christian, dealing with the generational baggage of our faith, with co-author Dr. Paul Nyquist. He co-authored the book with his son, Carson. And so, Dr. Nyquist, welcome back. Glad to have you.
Thank you very much. Glad to be back.
Yeah, and before the break?
We were just talking right before the break about the gifts that each of those generations have to offer each other and the things that we can learn one from the other. And you were commenting on, as your time as the president of Moody Bible Institute and spending time with 1,600 of them, that they're quick to recognize authenticity and to sniff out things that are real. And I think that's probably where we
yeah,
left off.
Yeah,
yeah. And that's right. You know, they want things to be real and authentic, and they have the ability to really detect that which isn't. And I don't think boomers are trying to be inauthentic. I just don't think that we learned necessarily the level of vulnerability that they have learned in this generation. I mean, everything goes on Facebook immediately, and so they are very accustomed to just telling everybody anything that's going on in their lives. You know, my generation, we didn't have those communication tools. We didn't learn that as well. And so, you know, we can appear to be inauthentic. I think it's more that we're just not learned in the areas of vulnerability like they are. So, but they can help us be authentic, you know. So we're not pasting on that plastic smile when we walk in the doors of church on Sunday, but we can be real with whatever's going on in our lives. I think that's important. We can learn that from them. They need us, though, too, Beth and Rob. I mean, what we can bring to the millennials is wisdom. You can't get wisdom except through time and experience. And, you know, they bring passion. Right. They bring energy. But they need mentors. They need people who can speak into their lives as well and just help guide them, like Solomon says in the book of Proverbs. You know, heed the wisdom that it brings you, my sons. And we can bring that to the table, too. It's just what we're trying to encourage in this book is a dialogue, a conversation between generations. Instead of the generations judging each other, which tends to happen now, you know, millennials are judging boomers and saying, you know, they're disconnected from society and they're too politicized. And boomers are judging millennials saying, you know, they're just lazy, self-absorbed narcissists, you know. And instead of judging, we need to have a conversation because there is a problem. 59%, according to Barna Research, 59% of millennials are checking out. And these are people who love Jesus, but they're not really excited about the church. And so they're just trying to find different alternatives to meet that need in their life. We have to have that conversation so we can understand each other, appreciate the differences, appreciate what each brings, and then move together in unity.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a great read. Fabulous that both you and your son are able to sort of bring those different perspectives to a single book. Where can our listeners find it? And perhaps get in contact with you as well.
Yeah, they can go through Amazon. It's on there. Moody Press is the one who published it. They can go to Moody and deal with it. But, it's available ebook, hardback, wherever you'd like to have it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Really, thank you. I think one thing that Rob and I are both passionate about is igniting conversations. We always say we want to ignite conversations among people that maybe aren't normally talking in order to create that sense of engagement and foster a culture of vulnerability. I mean, those are fantastic words. And so I just appreciate you putting a tool out there so that those conversations can continue. And I just want to say that publicly. I appreciate that because those 59%, man, that is no small statistic. And the consequence of a post-church generation is, that's a tough thing to swallow, to imagine what that would be like. So,
absolutely.
Again, we appreciate what you do at the collegiate level and certainly through this book in order to foster those conversations.
My privilege to be with you. Thank you, Beth. Thank you for Rob. Trust that you'll continue to inspire people in this area.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Dr. Nyquist. Blessings to you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All right. Man, that's a well-spoken guy, and he knows what he's talking about. He's around 1,600 students, president of Moody Bible Institute. I mean, not only just in a theoretical way, but he's digging into it with his son. I mean, he's banging it around with his own son. You know, why don't you like church? The church that I was pastoring, by the way. So,
and like I just was said, I mean, I got like all overwhelmed with emotion to think, holy cow, not 59% of like the country, but 59% of our believing population.
Yeah, millennials.
What's going to happen to 59%
right,
of our believers?
Right, and now we're talking about, it gets personal because we're talking about my son and daughter and your sons and daughters.
Absolutely.
And our listeners' sons and daughters, and maybe our listeners as well. We have listeners, who are listening to the show right now in their 20s and teens, and they're like, I'm all over that. That's why I don't like the church. That's why I don't go. Or in some cases, that's why we just started our own.
And different is not wrong. I think that's one thing. That storyline is as old, it doesn't matter what generation you call yourself in. Understanding that folks that might do things differently than you, that are younger than you, but there's some energy that can come from that.
As an educator, the interesting part, he brought up a little part, he was talking about country club stuff, and he mentioned that we built Christian schools. For protection, we've built mega churches. And it's interesting working in a Christian school that I can see that. I would do family interviews, and there would be some families who came and they wanted to come to a Christian school to protect themselves and their children from influence somewhere. But there's also a sort of a younger generation of parent, maybe elementary school, middle school parents who would come for interviews, and they'd like, I want to engage my kids. I want to build a Christian worldview in order to engage. And so the Christian, at least our Christian school, I would argue the Christian school movement in general, is going through that conflict itself. Like, we didn't build this school. Well, initially we might have built this school to be a place of protection to build our own subculture, but the families that are now wanting to populate that school are coming for a very different reason. And that's because they want raw, authentic, engaging places. So it's when he mentioned that, my ears perked up. I said, man, he is talking about what exactly happens at just where I work, at a Christian school.
And what do you think about, I mean, we're going to have a mega church pastor on in a couple weeks. I'd be interested in asking him, did it happen in spite of you? Because you have such a phenomenal message that great people attract great people in Holy Cow.
Yeah.
Or did you set out to be a one-stop shop for, the coffee bar and the fitness center?
Well, it's interesting. Brian Tome is going to be on. He's the pastor at Crossroads in Cincinnati, over 12,000 people. The interesting thing we're going to be talking to him about is their churches seem to figure out how to bridge this gap. They are engaging boomers, X, millennial. They're all coming in droves. So it's not a separate millennial thing or a separate boomer thing. And so, it'll be interesting to talk to him. Did that happen by accident?
Mm-hmm.
I doubt it. I mean, they're very strategic about things. So how did you do this? How did you engage people? How did you bridge this gap that Dr. Nyquist is talking about and Carson Nyquist are talking about in this book? So it'd be a great discussion.
And, I mean, not really having given it all that much thought, but you just realize, the older generation will go to churches that attract the younger generations because we're all desperate for it all to get passed along, where the younger generation might not go to a church that's based on the theories and principles you know, drive from the old generation because you think that's outdated. So really, yeah. Maybe the key is for us to stay on the cutting edge as the culture shifts.
Absolutely. And so just two, really, again, as we talked about in the opening, two totally different books, two totally different ideas going on, but both compelling things, you know, again, with Kim in the first segment, just her story of adoption in the Ukraine. And now really a story, Carson and his dad, who just happens to be the president of Moody Bible Institute.
Home for Christmas talking.
And so wrapped up in this is the story of a father and a son coming to grips with what makes us different and how can we bridge that gap. So,
I mean, if we're looking for conversations to inspire the day of our listeners, I think we've given them two more good conversations.
That's absolutely.
To have.
By the way, we didn't mention it last week, but if you are wanting to pass this show on, or you're just catching the tail end, and you're like, hey, what are they talking about?
What?
You want to go to our Facebook page or our website, either one, reallifewithbethandrob.com or Facebook page, Real Life with Beth and Rob. You can have access to all of our past shows or go to iTunes,
yes.
Real Life with Beth and Rob, and you can download them as a podcast. And this is the kind of show that you want to pass on, just some really interesting stuff. And so if you're intrigued by this or other shows, don't hesitate. Go there. Leave us a message on our Facebook page, for goodness sake. Say, hey, Beth,
you.
Rob, what's going on?
Have you ever thought about interviewing this person? I mean, we're always trying to think about, like,
that's a great idea.
Who is it that we think would inspire good conversations
that's
in your
right.
day?
Who
it's
have
not
you,
hard
who
to
have
get
you heard,
people on the radio.
You know,
so
who
you,
have you
tell
read?
Us, we will have it.
Absolutely. The best news about this all, honestly, and I'm finishing the circle.
Okay.
Is that you'll be able to actually see them after your LASIK surgery. You'll be able to read the material without any blurriness or anything like that because you have overcome your blindedness.
When they were doing the testing to see if I was a candidate, he goes, well, I'm going to check all three boxes. You're nearsighted, farsighted, and you have astigmatism. I said, oh, good. Well, you can fix something, right?
Yeah, I can do that in 2 minutes per eye for $800.
And I said, sold.
Sold. I'll do it. Because that would cost a lot more in the United States, and I'm sure that this bargain basement price is worth every little bit.
I am a good patient. Are you a good patient when you get, like, you know, sick,
well,
hurt, surgery?
We can talk about that another time, but I want to talk about how you're a good patient in the fact that your rehab from LASIK is to sit with your eyes closed for an hour.
Yeah, it is. I'm not very good at, like, complying with
Holy
the post-op
cow.
Instructions. But wouldn't that be fun for someone to prescribe to you a 10-day
yes.
nap?
By the way, I'd love to engage in whatever you're doing right now, honey, but I'm going to have to lie down with my eyes closed for an hour. Doctor's orders.
Yeah,
so I'll be napping or whatever.
Yeah, it hasn't happened so much the way it was supposed to, but, you know, I find myself in deep prayer more often. Just close my eyes when I have a prayerful thought.
Yeah. Well, hey, next week, two more great guests on the show. The first is a book called White Umbrella, over the more than 100,000 U.S. children struggling against the storm of sexual exploitation. It's about sexual slavery and things. So that'll be kind of a PG-13 segment. But, again, we keep coming back to this topic. Just like adoption and orphan care, this seems to be a topic that the American church is really starting to be aware of. And like we talked about today, you know, engaged, rough, all that kind of stuff.
This is Louis Giglio's mother, and she has just done some great stuff out of Italy.
Yep, and Cynthia Rookie is also going to be on. She's going to be talking about her book, Ragged Hope. So some great, compelling stuff. Another great show today, Beth.
I'm so
hanging
happy.
Out with you. It's so good.
Awesome.
So thanks for joining us on this Saturday morning. This is Real Life with Beth and Rob, and we hope you have a great Saturday.
Sure
until then, we'll see you next week.